Hello, big boys and girls, parents and grandparents, teachers, and everyone interested in AI and robotics. I'm Anastasia, and I'm bringing to your attention AI Snacks with Romy and Robbie, a podcast for technology muggles, not wizards. And I was reflecting recently about how to develop this very show, and I find it quite useful to bring people with quite a background to my program, not just mathematicians, statisticians, and those people who are building AI products and applications. What went really well was the show with Ray Mulstock, a professor of science fiction, literature, creative writing, and film of the University at Albany in New York. And I'm pleased to announce that Ray will return next week to this very program. And today, I would like to talk about AI and early childhood development. And I am with the studio with no one else than Cecilia Vaca-Jones. She is a former minister of social affairs in Ecuador. And her position there was very interesting because this ministry had a coordinating roles across a number of pillars in the government. For example, she was in charge of education and social policy, family affairs, and dealing with poverty and programs to elevate people out of poverty, then health. So a very comprehensive approach touching multiple touch points across policy making and the society. And Cecilia is an expert in early childhood. She was a CEO of Bernard van Leer Foundation in the Netherlands, and she is currently advising the government of UAE. And this country is tremendously interesting for everyone who is in AI, because this is the first country which introduced a curriculum compulsory for everyone. Education about AI in the society, starting with actually preschool programs and going throughout the whole school. The second country which will follow with a very comprehensive approach is actually China, but they start in fall, in September, and UAE has already started. So Cecilia has a treasure of experience in early childhood development and in policy design. She is not a mathematician and someone who builds AI, but she's exposed to AI. Has her concern about this family of technologies, and we are just very curious to hear her perspective. But I would love to start with a simple question. So early childhood, what is it? So how do we define early childhood? I guess there are several approaches across geographies.
Hello, Anastasia, and thank you for having me here. And of course, just having a conversation from different perspectives is always healthy and enriching. So let me start giving my own definition of what early childhood development is. So basically, when we refer to the early years, we refer from the minute of conception, actually, to the 5 years old or 8 years old. It's very different in every country, because every country kind of defines this early period of life in different ways or different stages. But most countries define it from 0 to 5. And most countries actually start working on early childhood policies during the pregnancy period. Yeah. Because during the pregnancy period, you can actually ensure that a baby's healthy from the minute they start their life. But for me, the most important thing is to keep in mind that when we're talking about early childhood development, we're talking about the early years of development. And it's very interesting, because sometimes when I tell people I work on the field of early childhood development, they immediately associate it with education. So the one thing I want to say, early childhood development is not about education. Early childhood development is about this holistic way of seeing the early development of human beings. So really understanding how can we make sure that the first years of life are the best years to truly help children thrive. And maybe one very important thing that not many people know is that during this period of life, it's the most important period where your brain is developing. So for me, what is fascinating about the early years is actually acknowledging that, for example, in the first 2 years of life, 80% of your neurological connections happen. So
yeah.
When you see the brain, actually what's fascinating when you talk about AI, and I think all the development on neuroscience, nowadays, when you see the picture of a brain of a baby, which is, it's with all the technology that we have now, you can clearly see the picture of a 2 years old baby that has been like well stimulated, well nourished. And it's fascinating to see how the size of the brain is almost the same size as an adult brain. And
yeah.
this gives you the real information of what's happening in the brain. So the brain of a baby of 2 years old is almost the same as the brain of an adult person. Just so you understand how big is the transformation of a human being on the first years of life.
And what are the most critical aspects in the development of cognition in the early years? So what kind of, jumps to your attention immediately?
So again, understanding the holistic perspective of this early development is understanding the cognitive, the emotional, and the motor development of a human being. And all of this is, of course, motivated or triggered by the connections that you do on your brain. And that's why I'm always so fascinated about neurosciences, because these connections that happen. So basically, if you would have to see this picture, basically, when a baby is born, they start making like millions connections.
Yeah.
And I remember when I started studying early childhood development many years ago, they used to talk about like a baby making 700 connections per minute. Nowadays, we know that a baby can make up to 1 million connections per second. So
wow.
It's
yeah.
incredible. This means that your brain, what's happening in your brain, and that's probably why we don't remember what's happening on our very earlier years. Like, I don't know of anyone who remembers anything that happened before 2 years. We start building our memories right after 2 years. But this is basically because during the first 2 years, our brains are so plastic and they can make so many like neurological connections that they're building what we call synapses, which are these healthy connections that happen between neurons that allow us to build the memories and allow us to build everything that has to do with our identity, with our motor skills, with our social skills. So this is basically what's happening in the brain of a baby in the very early years. And I think it's very important that everybody knows that, because sometimes we say, oh, but babies don't remember. Like I know a lot of my friends are like, oh, we're not taking the babies because to a trip, because anyhow they won't remember what's happening. But in reality, if you think that they're making this positive connections, the more exposed to a healthy environment they are, the more exposed to healthy social connections and relationships, the best for this healthy neurological connections. And this is very important that for everybody to know about.
Well, I mean, life is a miracle, and little humans, babies are a miracle. To my knowledge, when they just first come to this world after the birth, they don't see properly, so they don't have the same sharpness of their vision as adults, because they need to process so much. So there are some biological mechanism to prevent this overload, cognitive overload. At the same time, so we've discussed this when I was interviewing you for my Leading Through Disruption column. We discussed the language, and you are multilingual, so you are completely fluent in five languages, I guess. So exposing a baby to multiple languages is very beneficial, because they get this gift of the brain, which is kind of, pre-coded for getting more and more information, absorbing it, and it will then translate not just to the language acquisition, but to music, mathematics, etc. So could you talk a little bit about this aspect, exposing babies to foreign languages or multiple languages within a country?
Yes, I was very fortunate to grow up in a family where my mom's native language is English and my father's native language is Spanish. So I was exposed to different languages very early in my life. But in reality, afterwards, I learned that actually being exposed to multiple languages in your early life, what basically helps do is this healthy connections and synapses that we were talking before. Because as you were saying rightly, Anastasia, what happens with language is that it's like a coding of neuroscience, right? So we basically have linguistic codes for every single language. But what's also fascinating about languages is that languages are very close related to cultures and beliefs and values. So I'm a big defender of the importance of learning on your native language, because of course your native language is going to be that language that you're able to handle and in a very like a professional way, in a way that you can manage a broader vocabulary maybe. But also learning other languages allows you to activate other types of codes and values and ideas. So I think it's also fascinating from a cultural perspective. I was recently, many years ago, I studied Margaret Mead, which is a very famous anthropologist from the 20th century. But already in the 1930s, she was actually doing a lot of like ethnographies and anthropological studies. And one of her main arguments was the importance of really investing in the early years and protecting the way that young children learn in their own context and culture. And one of the theories that she had is that, of course, children who are brought up in a very specific culture learn about their values and the context that they are surrounded. And it's very important to protect some of the cultural values because that's the only way that they are translated from one generation to another. So I think I just wanted to say that it's not only language, but what it's important of what's happening in the brain and the definition of values and identity in a child. But language is also closely related to culture because, in a way, language is the best way to preserve culture in many ways. You also speak many different languages. And
That's
sometimes you
true.
even feel that you are a different person in every language, right? Like I can be very different when I speak Spanish, and you can get the best part of my Latina kind of background. But then I can also be very different on speaking English and kind of relating to some of the British values that I have from my mother's side's family. So all I want to say that it's fascinating to understand that when you are activating this opportunity and possibility for young children to learn multiple languages, is not only amplifying this possibility of making different codes in their brains, but it's actually ratifying this possibility of creating a specific identity with a culture and a place and a context. And I think this is very important, and we don't always understand because just think about the brain as the most complex network of connections, and for me, what's happening in the brain of a baby when and you were saying yes that they don't have like a full sight, they haven't developed their full senses because that's exactly what's happening when they're born. They're starting to make all these healthy connections and synapses, which enables them to actually then develop all these other social, emotional, and cognitive skills and motor skills because of the connections that they're able to do. What is fascinating,
That's so important, by the way, and this is such a huge difference to how AI learns language. AI does not know its language, but language acquisitions in machines comparing to language acquisition in humans, this it can't be more different. And actually, highlighting the differences is important because it forms our expectations towards communicating with machines.
But in a way, Anastasia, maybe let me ask you this question, because I guess that in AI, what's happening is you're feeding AI with the different codes of languages, right? So, for example, when AI is exposed to listening different languages and different dialects, what's basically happening is that they're collecting all this data that allows them to codify the different languages and then kind of like be able to transcribe these languages into the AI world.
Let me try to explain it. Yeah, what is happening there? Because it's really, it can't be more different than with humans. So you rightly emphasize that language is not just, let's say, syntax, and then you have the vocabulary, right? So we are speaking English now. English has probably 50,000 most common words. And of course, English is a treasure because it's not just, let's say, the British English or American English, but we have English in South Africa and in New Zealand and in Australia, and you take it. So there will be differences in semantics and in terms and how vocabulary is being applied and influenced by cultures which are local to the region. But the context is tremendously important. And context is where AI really struggles. So let me just explain. So there are those 50,000 words. How does AI learn? It does not learn. It gets exposed to the whole web. And a web before scanning of books, which started approximately like 2000-2001, started on scale, and Google started doing this to enlarge the web. It was a collection of websites, obviously. In the websites, we have language. Then the books came in. Then the whole bloggers came in, starting to produce content specifically for the internet and not first publishing something into a book. So those large language models, they are exposed to this whole variety of the web. And there is a saying now that internet is running out of language. So those large language models are running out of language. And what is interesting, it's not just the language, those are tokens. So token in English is probably maybe 2/3 of a word or 1/3 of a word sometimes. They are in ChatGPT, they are only 3,000 real words. Everything else is token. And token is, for example, those gerundium endings like ing, working, listening, or iced, computerized. So this is a token. It has some meaning, but it's not like the whole world. So you won't really grasp the whole semantic out of being given this token. And the corpus of training is this internet. Yeah. So, AI is getting trained, and once it's trained with help of neural networks, and attention mechanisms, which is a property of those new large language models, it gets frozen. So we assume AI is in conversation with us because we prompt. AI is not in conversation with us. It was pre-trained. And what we do with prompting, we are shifting vectors in a certain semantical space, which allows the model to give us, let's say, faster and maybe better results. And then there is a so-called temperature, which humanizes the LLM. Without the temperature, we would receive a median of the answer. And that won't be human, because human communication has all kind of, let's say, hesitations and confusions and maybe some emotions. And depending on what genre are you writing in with the help of AI, you would assess, I would like to sound very formal, or I would love to sound very aggressive or friendly. And these questionnaires actually regulate the so-called temperature factor to allow the answer to kind of, you know, respect what you are aiming at. But AI does not know it's a language. It will do the same with sounds, with the music. It will do the same with numbers, yeah? So you just kind of shifting those tokens around and getting your answer. And you can actually prove that I'm correct in what I'm telling you. So you prompt today something, you return to the same question 3 days later, and you prompt again, you will not receive the same results. So AI has already forgotten what it was asked, unless it's in the query, and then you just click on the same. But if you remove everything from the field, you will receive a different answer and a different result, which is kind of interesting. So the context, there are tons of IP, intellectual property, being generated in terms of getting context into the equation. Some people, computer scientists who are brilliant, believe that LLMs decoded the language. So they decoded syntax and semantics. I don't believe it. I'm a linguist by training. I'm with Noam Chomsky. So those LLMs don't have this inborn native function of a language. They can't distinguish between natural languages and artificial languages. So humans, interestingly, they can immediately say, even if it's a Chinese or Hindi and I don't speak it, I will understand it's a human language. So AI can't. And sometimes they fantasize, hallucinate, and make up their own words according to the properties of the linguistic environment. So it will take time before we get Samantha in her, in LLM. So the same implementation as we saw in the movie, her. So this story, this relationship between Samantha, the voice of an OS, and Theodore, who is actually human, and he writes love letters. He's a writer as his job. So not the AI is writing love letters, but humans are writing love letters. And what is interesting, he's having the relationship with an OS, but he's in charge of actually addressing humans with his human thoughts and his human voice, and uses technology only to, let's say, process what he's doing. Like, please open up the new page. And yes, AI will mimic the handwriting. So it's actually a beautifully designed environment of this movie, which elevated itself to be a cult in Silicon Valley across technology makers. But once again, it's a huge data set from the internet. It's a neural network with multiple layers. It's attention mechanisms which allow to pay attention to certain things which are important. For example, if I read a book and you read the same book and I'm asking you what color was this dinosaur. So this attention heads will kind of, you know, click only on pieces of text which will reflect the dinosaur and nothing else. So this is the attention, yeah? Attention is all you need, yeah? Vectors, so mathematical expression on where to go to and what to group according to certain characteristics. So this is important. Of course, I'm simplifying. And then it will give you a result. A certain result applying the temperature mechanism to sound more human, yeah. But it's a machine. So there's no communication. There's no response. It's quite flat. And it's up to your expectations. What do you want from this machine?
Yes, and that's what's fascinating, right? Because when you go back to understanding how the brain of a baby is actually determining all these amazing capacities and skills that we are able to develop as human beings, which I truly don't think we're ever going to get to the point that a machine does that.
Yeah.
Because of the complexity and the different layers of what's happening in the brain, right? And you were saying, it is quite interesting, for example, when a baby is born, for example, blind, what I do think neuroscience and AI is doing nowadays, which is quite interesting, is I think nowadays they can study early on, are this brain connections that are happening in the brain of a baby, are this the healthy connections that a baby needs in order to develop all their social, emotional, and physical skills? And just because of understanding the different images of brains, AI can definitely help, for example, have early diagnosis of the conditions of the brain.
And absolutely.
They can probably alert early on if they see there might be like any delays on one of the development phases of a child and a baby, especially on the early time of developing the brain. And this is fascinating about AI because of this capacity of like collecting a lot of data and probably having this capacity to compare different images and then alert of specific things that might not be going on the right pathway.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And this is, I mean, AI is a very powerful tool. It's a very exciting tool. And if your domain is clearly defined and you have, for example, data sets on brain imagery, for example, or so this attempts of a baby to speak, yeah, or what the eye looks like, and you have this millions and millions of data points, AI will spot things which us humans, we can't. But it's not because we're stupid. It's just the biological property. And this being not tired of a machine to look into the pixels or to process tokens or particles of sound. So this is why we need those machines, and why this is why they are so useful.
Yeah, and especially with children, you know, because sometimes in these early years, you can only understand the delays, one, that children start manifesting their behaviors. And usually behaviors start at 2 years old. You know, it's on the first stage of life, you're just learning the very basics of like developing your sight, developing your sound, developing all your different capacities. But only at 2 years old, you're able to manifest a lot of these behaviors. But going back to the importance of these other vectors or these other conditions that are given because of the context, and this is what I think it's very important from what we have studied from an anthropological point of view. There are things about the context and the culture that you only live because of, or you only learn because of the experience that you live. And, and for me, this is the one capacity that human beings actually have, which is like we have the possibility of making positive or negative experiences surrounding the well-being of children, right? And that's there's also another very famous neuroscientist, Charles Nelson, that, for example, he studied children that were institutionalized and like orphans that were institutionalized that weren't like really exposed to a lot of like emotional caregiving or like a thriving environment that would really kind of like help them develop these healthy connections. And what he was able to prove on his study was actually that children that were institutionalized had huge delays just because they didn't have this supportive context or this supportive environment that could really help them develop this this positive neurological connections. So I think this is super important to understand and know that there's something about the emotional context and environment that we can create for children, which is fundamental to create the right foundations for a healthy development. And this healthy development will then determine, you know, the rest of their lives because of their identity, their health, their motor skills, everything else. So it's actually super important to invest in these early years.
You know, this is so interesting what you are saying. So this study, so children who aren't privileged and they are growing up in an environment which simply can't provide certain things. And I'm wondering whether sometimes technologies can help somehow to mitigate certain damage. And I remember, so in the episode 34 of this podcast, I was interviewing Mike Riscala, and he created a company, Snorble. And Snorble is a device. It's, well, I can call it a robot. So it's very lovable. It's like an egg with big eyes, friendly voice, and it talks to children. It's for preschool children. So earlier childhood development, and it's focused on developing positive habits in children. For example, how do you brush your teeth? Or, for example, we are teaching you to meditate, or we are teaching a song or how to read. And children were engaging with Snorble for 30 minutes a day, an average, and very positive experiences and proprietary technology stack. So nothing, it gets out, you don't collect data. So beautiful technical implementation. And I'm just wondering, if you are in environments where you are deprived of communication and there is a loving mother and father and an auntie and a grandmother, so the kid can't really communicate, maybe sometimes we can, I'm not saying substitute, but provide some help with those tools to get kids evolve in a better way. So it's not a full solution, but it might mitigate certain damages. So this is like my question. And I know you are very much about policy making. So what do you think about applying robotic toys, smart toys, AI in such environment?
I think that in general, like AI, robotics, technology are now part of our daily lives. So for me, it's about more, I think it's more about developing good content and making sure that whatever we're able to develop from a technological perspective is really kind of like supporting this development rather than replacing this. For example, I don't think you can replace caregiving, but you can support positive caregiving. And there are different platforms. I have a very good friend, Rob Hugh, who's a doctor, and he developed this new platform that's called Tandem. And basically what this platform is trying to do is it's really trying to promote, for example, positive storytelling, where basically you do the story with your child and you basically try to, like, you spend time together using technology, but building your own stories, which are also supported with the AI imagery. So for example, I'm just giving an example of like good content in technology. So for me, more than the, you know, I'm, of course, I'm still skeptical of what is going to be like the effect of being exposed to so much technology. And I do think that we need to find a balance between how we use technology and how we balance that with the connection with the rest of the world. And you know, for example, for me, what I know, and there's a lot of evidence of the importance of children spending time in nature, right?
Yeah.
But is there a way that we can use AI to actually trigger habits that push children and families to spend more time outdoors and in nature rather than banning the use of technology, right? So for me, it's also always thinking, what are the other opportunities that we're giving children? So it's not just about like banning or forbidding or limiting the, for example, the screen time. Is actually, okay, if you're using the screen time, if you have specific screen time, are we exposed to good content and good quality? It's similar to food, right? Like now we're exposed to a lot of processed food. Do we know what we're eating? Are we eating healthy food? Do we have the option of eating healthier food that it's natural and it's not processed? Is that a choice for everybody? I think it's the same when it comes to the content that we're generating with technology. Can we access good content and good quality of the content? And I think from a policy perspective, this is what we should be worried about, is about regulating good content and making sure that that families and children can access good content. I think we need to find ways and mechanisms that we can ban bad content, you know, as when you ban like this food is not healthy for children. And, you know, there are many countries around the world that are now using, for example, food labeling to alert people of bad content of food. I think probably having something similar for bad content on media use and could be interesting. And I think that's a lot of what we are working on the policy perspective nowadays. Around the world, there's a lot of discussion. Also because it's going so fast that what you need to know is there's an ethical problem there that we need to be aware that we need to have some control of the kind of content that the technology is generating in order to help raise kids. The other thing, I think it's also very important to consider the different stages of development of children. And the content needs to somehow relate to those different stages, right? Because there's a natural process of children developing, and maybe adapting that content to that natural process is important. And in order to do that right, I think we need to involve children as well, like in developing these technologies. So this is a very like interesting approach that we're talking a lot about nowadays, which is, okay, if we are doing this for children, let's make sure that we are also doing it with children so we can really get their inputs when developing this new technology.
I mean, actually, you gave me some very interesting thoughts now. So first, this comparison with food industry, I think it's brilliant. But if we just recall why we are in the environment we found ourselves into, so the history after the Second World War was just to feed a population and to bring calories into the population. So the idea of health was very different than what we faced 80 years later, right? So this is why, you know, tons of sugar, it should not rot. So those conservants, you know, emulgators. So everything which healthy people consider poison today, it was driven by research and necessity to keep food and just provide food and a lot of calories to feed everyone. And then actually we learned, obviously, of course, R&D, of course, science. So we know more about biology than, you know, 80 years ago. So with AI, my concern is we don't have that much time. And for me, so the issues of AI is not that they are biases, so we can discuss those, and that neural networks is a black box, so we can't really see what every layer is doing. But the issue is that overconsumption might, like it's leading to bad health, overconsumption and cutting corners in education might lead to degradation of population. And I'm saying more or less to every of my guests, I see like two paths. So those who are really great and they know what they're doing, they will be elevated with AI. AI is a tool, another skill set, more capabilities, fantastic. Those who are on fast food track and cut corners because they don't want to study math, they don't want to write. So it's more or less a recipe to disaster. And the answer is not in AI. The answer is somewhere else. It's how do we develop critical thinking and cognition, which sometimes is supported with tech, right? With the tool, but not replaced by it. And I'm just wondering, in early childhood development, I know you are very much engaged in designing urban spaces. Mm. Have you ever seen interesting concepts of designing a playground or designing a schoolroom or a kindergarten facility where kids are moving in between of nature and maybe technology and else? Do you have any examples for us on that?
Yeah, so... Again, for me, technology is nowadays everywhere because basically, you know, everybody and many kids are actually most of the time just carrying a phone with them. So for me, it's again, it's actually finding that balance. How can we use new technologies to support creativity, to support healthy habits, to support healthy parenting or positive parenting rather than technology replacing them? And that's the beauty of that. And for example, now that I'm very engaged in trying to support building better cities for children and families, for me, one of the most important areas of work is actually working on the public spaces. So yeah. A playground, a park, a court, you know, a street, because streets is one of the most beautiful public spaces that we have in cities. And, you know, streets can actually be like playful, or streets can be the best place to meet others, or streets can be the best from an early childhood perspective. You know, usually toddlers or young children usually do short journeys, right? Like they don't walk long distances, but they actually walk short distances. But these short distances that they walk can be very motivating for their creativity and for playful ways of learning and for positive ways of connecting with neighbors and other people that live in their own context. So again, we go back to the context. So what I'm really trying to use is actually, I think a part of the work that we're doing in Abu Dhabi is really trying to engage communities on building their own public spaces and finding ways and mechanisms that we can make local people of their communities kind of engage on activating the public spaces. So what is it that my neighborhood, and this can be very local and very kind of like tailored and customized to what local people need and want in their own neighborhood, because and this is the beauty of cities, right? Like the soul of the city is defined of what people can bring to the city and what people can make up in their own neighborhoods. So I think a lot of what we're trying to do is in the public spaces is just trying to find which are creative, innovative ways that we can bring play as a mechanism to bring people together. And in a fascinating place like Abu Dhabi, but also in many other cities around the world, you know, the diversity of cultures that meet in the urban spaces is really good. But are we really learning about this diversity of cultures? Are we creating a context that really allows us to thrive because we learn from different perspectives and different ways of thinking and living, while we can still emphasize on local values? As I was telling you, again, for me, from an anthropological point of view, the most important thing is also, are we also teaching our young children to kind of strengthen their values and their beliefs, which nowadays seems so important in the context of this frenetic world? I think it's very important that we kind of like stop everything and really make sure that children are not just learning knowledge and a lot of content, but that they're also working on their own identity and their own values in having the time to develop their own beliefs based on this very local culture that is feeding them with different experiences. And these experiences are definitely not going to be always, you know, triggered by technology. Again, technology can support that, but I don't think they can replace that. So the context and the experience and the human experience and connection that children need to thrive needs to happen in a very like human level. I'm still a big believer of that.
No, absolutely. It's all about humanity. I'm just thinking that we require a lot of skills to orchestrate this dialogue with communities, right? And to have some experts, for example, on media and media content and content development and technology, who would then provide this expertise to the local leaders so that they can build those parks, those playing grounds, streets and schools, and maybe engage in some local festivals or what else to really facilitate creativity. And so much can be done in every corner. So I remember when my daughter was very, very young, I discovered an app, and she loved music from the very beginning. So she's 16, she's a pianist, she wins competitions. And when she was 2 years old, we discovered this app. And it was Saint-Saëns, so the carnival of animals. And it was played by Orchestre National de France. And every single fragment was obviously played. So there were instruments, they were shown. But then an illustrator provided this environment where out of sudden images were created, and out of sudden the lion marched through the row of musicians, and he roared, and the conductor roared at him. So he was, you know, it was beautiful. So this kind of communication between, you know, a graphic and an illustration, and then the real humans. So smartly done. And I'm just like, this is where technology can facilitate and enhance, not replace. And I wished we would have more of that with local colors and local cultures and human values, ultimately.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of like beautiful examples of, I was recently in a symposium that they were presenting some really interesting cartoons that were inspired and done with African diversity of cultures and beliefs and values. And you know, even those simple experiences, I think it's fascinating because, you know, there's so much diversity that we need to learn about. But again, coming to this idea of like, how do we ensure like a healthy development for children? I do think that we need to be very creative and careful about like making sure that these experiences that children are having early on in life are real experiences that can help them shape their own identity based on these positive experiences that we can expose them to. And we can all contribute to that, right? Like it's not something that should just be, I think sometimes we give caregivers and parents so like all the responsibility of like raising a child. But I like that saying that says, you need a town and a village to raise a child. Because I think it's true, right? Like it's not, yes, of course, parents have like the immediate responsibility of making sure that their child is healthy and safe. But I think that the broader community also has the responsibility of triggering this positive context where they can actually have positive experiences in those early years and through their life. And I think that's our responsibility. It's all of us, like we are all responsible for giving children the possibility and the opportunity to have these positive experiences rather than trauma or denying them these experiences of and possibilities of learning in good ways.
I think it was a silver lining of this conversation. Communities matter. It takes a village to raise a human being, and we all can contribute. Thank you so much, Cecilia. It's really, I'm really thrilled to know you. I wish you all the best, and we will reconnect for sure. I'm learning so much from you. Really, thank you. I'm very grateful that you came to this podcast. So that was another episode of AI Snacks with Romy and Robbie. By the way, the real Romy decided to sleep instead of participating in this recording. He was very, very tired yesterday. I had a group of friends home, so they petted him. So it was very tiresome. So he has a day off today. And so I'm encouraging everyone to look up Romy, Robbie, and the Secrets of Sleep. By the way, Secrets of Sleep, it's not about sleeping, but it's about sleep algorithms, which are very useful for the functionalities of neural networks. And next week, I will bring back Ray Mulstock, and we will discuss Her, a wonderful sci-fi movie, which is iconic and very iconic to the evolution of open AI. Thank you. See you soon. Bye-bye.